And welcome to Ask an Atheist. We are a weekly educational call-in program dedicated to atheism, skeptical inquiry, and the separation of church and state. We air live from SCAN Studios in Seattle every Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and are archived online at www.askanatheist.tv. I'm your host this week, Mike Gillis, and joining me again is Case.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Good to be here. We're doing sort of an unusual episode today. For one, we're going to ask people to please limit the scope of their calls to the topic. Not something we normally do, but it's something that, given the breadth that we want to hit on the topic, the amount of detail.
We have a lot of material to cover in this episode. So what we're basically asking is, if you call, keep your calls central to the topic of the collapse of the World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2. We'll actually get into that. And to keep your calls short, get right to the point. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I guess you're wondering why have a topic like this on an atheist show. Well, I think primarily it's that the reason that we are atheists is because we're applying skeptical principles to questions of religion and religious claims. Now we're simply just redirecting that same methodology to other topics, other weird fringe beliefs that people hold on to, conspiracy theory, pseudoscience, things like that.
Right. It being September 12th, we thought an appropriate topic to look at would be, was 9/11 an inside job? As reported by the 9/11 Folks for the Truth, AE Architects and Engineers for the 9/11 Truth, by Loose Change and other documentarians who claim that 9/11 was an inside job. They claim that controlled demolitions brought down World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2.
And scientists and scholars like Charlie Sheen.
Right. So myself being a skeptic, basically I thought I'd look at the evidence. And basically, you know, one thing that people think about when they think about skeptics is they think of skepticism as a position. It's not. It's a method. It's a method of looking at evidence. So basically what I did, with an open mind, I looked at all the evidence for a controlled demolitions. And to be perfectly honest with you, I found it wanting, and we'll actually get into that. I think we should just go ahead and roll the first clip.
Oh, we should probably do some quick announcements real quick.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, go ahead with some announcements first.
The first announcement we have before we hit the topic is Seattle Atheists, which is one of the organizations that we are, I guess they're sort of a sister organization to the show in a lot of ways. They're a friend of the show.
Right.
A lot of the people who work on the show are board members or members of Seattle Atheists.
Yeah, and we're both very active in the organization.
Yeah. So they're going to be having their elections for a new board next Sunday at September 19th. If you want to get some information on that, you can just go to www.seattleatheists.org. You have to be a member to vote in the elections, but they will sign you up at the event.
Right.
So
it's really a great way to, steer the course of atheism, local atheism, in terms of what's important to you. You know, hear what the candidates have to say, you know, and vote for who you think is best represents what you think atheism should be.
And it's also worth mentioning, yes, we have a TV show, but the one thing that we can't provide through the TV show is a sense of community. That's something that Seattle Atheists exists to do. Gives people the opportunity to meet with like-minded people, and I guess in a lot of ways it gives them a place to go. I mean, it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of social aspects. We also get involved in a number of activities. But again, you can find that all on www.seattleatheist.org.
Right.
Second one, and we announced this last week, which is we are up for 4 SCAN awards. SCAN TV, which is the public access network that we are on, the Seattle Community Access Network. They have an annual award show, and we're up for, I believe, 4 awards. It's like favorite religious program.
That's my favorite one.
That's my favorite one. Yeah. I want to win that one. Simply, I want to see the jaws drop on that.
Yes. Best live show? Is that right?
Live show. Best live show, best new show, and best local show.
Right.
So go to scantv.org, and it takes 30 seconds to vote, and let's climb to the top of the public access mountain.
Yeah, and you've already got your dress picked out for the event.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. All right, so with that, why don't we go ahead and roll the first clip? That way we can set the emotional tone for that we want to set for the rest of the show. So go ahead and roll that for us.
Good morning, and it is not a good morning in New York City.
I just thought, oh my gosh, why are people flying planes into buildings?
A major disaster, a plane crash into the World Trade Center.
I'm gonna die, aren't I?
No,
say your prayers.
I'm gonna die.
Man, say your prayers.
We were afraid for how many other people were gonna perish on that day.
It was hard to bear.
John hears a sound he'll never forget.
It was like someone's dropping some heavy equipment, and it was coming frequently. Boom! Boom!
It's the sound of bodies slamming into the pavement.
People were jumping from the floors above, and now we realized that the situation upstairs was very grim.
Then, the South Tower begins to buckle.
I feel a tremendous rush of air. I feel heat. I feel ash. And it's just...
Okay. So basically, when it comes to the World Trade Center towers, I mean, that clip is really tough for me to always watch. I've seen it at least 24 times now. And still always tough. It's easy to forget what it was like to be there for those people and the horror, on the ground. And, we have people hanging out of buildings and, calling 911 and saying, I think I'm going to die. The operator just trying to calm them down. You're going to be fine. Don't worry. But, we all have that vision of hindsight. We all know that that person is dead. And I think that that's something that gets lost in this whole thing is that when truthers talk about it being an inside job and things like that, for me, the thing that I find most repulsive about it is that they are kind of climbing on the backs of this horror, using it as a means to indoctrinate people into this paranoid lifestyle. And that really bothers me. It's not only it's not only intellectually dishonest, but it's a cheap way of self-aggrandizing themselves. And I refer directly to Richard Gage of 9/11 Truth, Stephen Jones, David Ray Griffin, all the Dylan Avery, all the leaders of this group that are and I've looked at their evidence. It is, and without question, it's intellectually dishonest. And I thought that what we'd do is in this show we'd go through their evidence, take a look at it, and break it down one by one. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, I spoke to I met with 9/11 Truthers down at Westlake Mall. They're giving out pamphlets and flyers and DVDs like they always do. And obviously, it's the anniversary yesterday. And I didn't go down there to debate them or to engage them in any attack way. I really just wanted to get a sense as to where they were at. Why did they believe that it was an inside job? And person for person, I should say only two people really had a very lucid way of explaining what they thought. But the folks that I did talk to all used the same talking points, and all those talking points were from architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, Richard Gage, Stephen Jones, Dylan Avery, the four horsemen of the 9/11 Truth.
Instead of being something really grassroots, we're talking about much more astroturf. This is very top-down.
Right.
You're clearly getting talking points from somebody else and really getting the sense that any of these people have put any real effort into investigating this on their own.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they encourage everyone to research it for themselves, but when they say research, they mean go to this website and look at these websites only. I've actually gone to their websites, looked at all the points that they made and broke them out and taken a look at them and saw that they didn't hold up. As a skeptic, I don't care whether or not they were right or wrong. I care about the method they used to get to their position. Was it intellectually honest? And to be honest with you, it doesn't hold up. Mm. So that's what I thought we'd take a look at. So let's take a look at slide one. Slide one is pretty much the consensus that most people have about the 9/11 attacks, that World Trade Center Tower 1 was hit at 8:46, World Trade Center Tower 2 was hit at 9:02, World Trade Center Tower 2 fell first, and then World Trade Center Tower 1 fell second. In the film 9/11 Mysteries, they claim that that's very suspicious. Isn't it suspicious that World Trade Center Tower 2 was hit second but fell first? Mm-hmm. And if there was anything to lead you along a series of pseudoscientific questions, that's it. That logically, apparently, that World Trade Center Tower 1 should have fell first.
Well, there's this sort of assumption that every one of these plane attacks is going to be exactly the same, that it's going to hit in exactly the same place, it's going to hit exactly the same speed, it's going to hit exactly the same angle. and that these buildings are absolutely identical. And even if that was true, you can't make the assumption that they're going to fall at the same time.
Right.
I mean, there's countless different possibilities that these things could go differently, and indeed there were.
Right. So let's go on to slide 2A, and that is the scientific consensus. In a nutshell, here's the scientific consensus, is that the impact of the planes combined with the fires from the jet fuel and the combustible furniture and things inside there caused a weakening of the steel. That weakening of the steel caused the first floor to collapse into the top floor to collapse into the next floor, and the kinetic energy of that, the following floor was unable to hold up, and then you have this progressive collapse that followed through the rest of the building. It's one of those things, like, it's counterintuitive because you would think a building would tip over, but the math is there. The numbers do hold up when you actually look at how the building collapsed and the different ways that the structure came down. It does hold up. It's valid. So let's take a look at. We're actually going to jump to slide 3, and that is the controlled demolition. So I thought we'd just jump to what the truthers claim. In a nutshell, it goes like this: the collapse of the World Trade Center towers 1 and 2 was not caused by plane crash damage. Yeah, we're gonna jump ahead a couple slides. Was not caused by plane crash damage that occurred, nor by the resulting fire damage, but by explosives installed in the building in advance. And the folks who put together this hypothesis, we're going to go to slide 4. The folks who put together this hypothesis, I've actually broken down their claim and said, okay, well, why do you think it was controlled demolitions in the building? We're going to go one more slide to slide 4. Keep going, you can do it. Anyway, if you look at their hypothesis, and a hypothesis should go as follows. Demolitions were planted here, and then a hypothesis will have a test where you kind of test that hypothesis. So you'd maybe model that out, put some demolitions in there, and then watch a model collapse or do things that test your theory. And instead, what the truthers have done, their hypothesis consists largely of attacking the official story. Let's take a look at the hypothesis here. Their hypothesis is as follows. The World Trade Center was designed to handle the jet impact of a similar 707, that jet fuel cannot melt steel, that it carried all the hallmarks of a controlled demolition, that there were rivers of molten metal that indicate nanothermite that was seen in the debris. It was impossible, they say, for towers to fall onto their own footprint without explosives, and that the buildings fell at free fall speed. Also, that no high-rise steel structure has ever collapsed due to fire. And finally, that nanothermite residue was found in dust samples. And I think anybody who believes in the inside job theory will say that I've pretty much very fairly expressed their arguments. In a nutshell, that's it. I mean, I haven't twisted their words. I mean, this is what they say. If you look at their placards and their signs, you go to their websites, it's pretty much this. A seasoned skeptic will look at these and say, well, where's the evidence in your favor? You've, for the most part, you've attacked someone else.
Yeah.
And I like to think of it as...
Not a straw man, for instance.
Say again?
Not attacking a straw man. I will say that I've looked at truther stuff. I've talked to truthers. And their theories are just so all over the board. Whether planes existed, it was a hologram. I've heard some really,
laser
really...
beams. Yeah.
I've heard some really, really bizarre stuff that just goes all over the board. But at the heart of all of them... is this controlled demolition theory.
Right.
That this seems to be like the hypothetical, you know, the proverbial spot on the Death Star, that if this part of the theory can be debunked, then the rest of it simply just, you know, no pun intended, collapses. And this is the one thing that seems to be the common denominator under everything that
exactly right, yeah. Yeah, so that's why I thought it would be really, really interesting to go after this part of the theory. Instead of the hundreds of claims that are made by truthers, why not go for one that is pretty much the spinal column of the whole thing, and that is the collapse of World Trade Center 1 and 2 was done by controlled demolitions. So I remember once I went to a Richard Gage presentation at Seattle Town Hall, and Richard Gage has a very interesting way of presenting to the audience. Pretty much what he does is at the beginning of his presentation, he'll ask for a show of hands, how many people believe in the official story? And he'll count out the number very dramatically.
It's kind of a loaded term already.
Right, exactly right. He'll open with a loaded question. How many people believe the official story? instead of the FEMA report or, you know, whatever be the
scientific consensus.
Right. Thank you. So what he does, he'll ask then. A number of people raise their hands. He'll ask again midway. A fewer amount of people raise their hands. And he'll ask again at the end of the show. And by then, there's so much pressure for you. There's so much social pressure for you to not raise your hand that if you do, you are the doofus. Well, guess who raised their hand? I raised my hand. And I was immediately mobbed by people. People pressed DVDs into my hand. They came over. They took pictures of my face. They were intimidating me. They were trying to intimidate me into changing my mind. And I refused to do it. But that gives you a sense of it's not science. It's social pressure. It's asking questions that aren't valid. It's using logical fallacies. It's using videos that play on an emotional tone with a propaganda angle to them. That's pretty much the case of The Inside Job is.
Yeah, I've seen so many of the similarities between the methodology and the tone that they use and creationists.
Yes.
Where they use the same backwards methodology where they start with an answer and then they cherry-pick evidence to rationalize that answer. That's something you just don't see into the scientific method. When somebody disagrees, people want to see your facts. They don't immediately want to shout you down. Like if somebody comes out and says, no, I actually have the evidence. I say, well, what's your experiment? Have you gotten a paper published in a peer-reviewed journal? And another similarity between the 9/11 conspiracy theorists and the creationists is their way of getting around that is to create their own
bogus peer-reviewed journal.
Yeah. It's peer-reviewed. It's like reviewed by other conspiracy theorists.
Yeah, so literally like, they're their own peers.
Yes.
Yeah, literally.
What does it take to get your paper rejected by one of those journals? Has a paper ever been rejected by one of those journals?
Well, I'm only aware of one, but the parallels that you make with regards to intelligent design and truthers is the similarities are actually very, very are amazing. First of all, instead of having their own science, they attack the science of the other. So, you know, there's the gap in the fossil record, which would be the intelligent design.
The assumption of a false dichotomy, too, that simply all they need to prove their point is to disprove another one.
Exactly.
Where instead that would put you at sort of a neutral, I don't know.
Right. You have your own version of irreducible complexity. You have special pleading. These are all the same tactics.
Guilt, ignorance, too. I don't know any other way this could have happened.
Therefore, it has to be this. You see a lot of the same tactics used by truthers in their arguments as was done by the intelligent design community. It's really, the parallels are actually fascinating. So anyway, let's go ahead and take a look at slide number 5. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to look at how the World Trade Center was designed in terms of its column placement. Slide number 5, pull it up for me. So basically here's a cutaway top section view of the World Trade Center towers. We have 47 center core columns. We have perimeter columns around the edges. And here's what the design of the World Trade Center Tower, how it was different from buildings of its time, is that core columns were generally distributed evenly throughout the entire floor. But what they did differently with this was to put them all in the center. And what that did, the benefit of that was that it allowed for tenants to be able to put in different kinds of furniture and different wall placements. And it gave tenants more freedom to be able to place their office workers. The downside to this was that it made it uniquely vulnerable to a plane hitting it. What you have is you have a wide gap. You have the plane punches through a core, a perimeter column. It has this wide field to go through, and then all the core columns are placed together. It's kind of like the reason why in a platoon everybody spreads apart, because if a grenade hits, you'll all be affected by it. So the core columns, they're all together. Pull that graphic up again for me, please. The core columns are all together. And
when something punches through there,
they're all affected.
There's that immediate resistance from the outside columns, but then nothing to slow it down as it hits all of them at once.
Right, right. So that's I will say that there are buildings now that are designed the same way that took lessons from World Trade Center Tower, and they built their offices the same way with a core column in the middle and a wide area for office workers to work around it. So. You know, before you panic, they've learned how to fix the redundancy in these buildings so that if a plane did hit them, the building would survive.
And so, the World Trade Center buildings, those were built in the 1960s?
It was designed in the 1960s. I think it was started in the late 60s and finished in 1974.
Okay. So potentially it was a pretty controversial decision to have it built in this way. Basically, they were choosing function or form over function, the ability to adapt the office space to the tenant's degree over the potential safety issues.
Right. The building was made of lighter materials than typically. Basically, each floor was put on a truss instead of a girder. And a truss is a lighter way of making a floor. And we have a graphic for it, but I don't think we'll be able to go that far back on it. Let's go ahead and jump over to slide number 6, because I wanted to show a cutaway of the towers from a side view. And basically what it does is it shows the way it'll show the elevator placement as it was done in the World Trade Center towers. If you look to the right there, you see that basically we're looking at the elevators here, and you see that not all elevators went to the top. They went to what's known as a sky lobby. If you worked on the top floor, you would take an elevator from the bottom, or you'd take an express elevator to a sky lobby. You would do it again to another sky lobby, and then finally to your floor. And that's basically how it worked. That's the only way they could fit all those elevators into a building that tall. So a lot of times truthers will say, well, you know what, there were squibs. As the building came down, there were all these squibs that exploded out, and that's evidence of the fact that there were bombs placed in the building. But what they don't say is that although not all the squibs happened on a sky lobby floor, every floor that was a sky lobby had a squib. And what that suggests...
You're talking about an outward explosion.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And a squib is a term used by movie makers when they have an explosion. It's just a puff of air and dust and things like that. I'm so in the vernacular, I sometimes forget to...
Yeah,
to
I mean, that's what the sky lobby is. It's largely a large pocket of air rather than having office buildings and having it partitioned off, be one large area.
Right. So as the building came down, as the floors collapsed, you have this perfect tunnel that can push all the air out of a sky lobby. So anyway, that's just a point I wanted to mention. So let's go ahead to slide number 8. And I think that this best illustrates the shape of the World Trade Center towers. And that was, it was considered what's known as a tube within tube design. We have the core columns in the middle, and we have the perimeter columns on the edge, and that's what held the building up, okay, in a nutshell. That's going to be a slide that's going to be very important when it comes to when we look at the topple over scenario and why it was impossible for this building to topple over.
Okay.
So let's go on to slide number 9. And that is the first assertion made by truthers, and that is that the World Trade Center towers was designed to handle a 707. And to make this assertion, they quote Leslie Robertson, who was the chief structural engineer of this building. And he says the following, and he does say the following. He says, the World Trade Center towers were designed to handle the impact of a Boeing 707. But in true truther style, they cut out the rest. That's very important stuff.
Oh, this is sort of like when people quote mine, the Darwin thing about the eye.
Right. Right. Yeah, in that case, Darwin was being honest about not knowing something, and then he goes on to, well, he's honest about irreducible complexity in the eye, and he goes on to break that apart.
Yeah, the connection between two paragraphs is essentially, but.
Yes.
And then it's saying, well, it seems like it would be impossible for blank to happen, but it did.
Right, and they'll cut out the but part. So anyway, let's take a look at what Leslie Robertson said. He said they had designed the building for the largest impact plane of its time. But the difference is that this plane was flying a lot faster than what they accounted for. The 707 that they had planned for in the 1960s, they were thinking that it was going to be flying through fog, trying to land, and maybe made a mistake and hit the buildings at about 180 miles an hour. They were not planning on a fully loaded jet with 10,000 gallons of fuel hitting at 490 miles an hour.
Something else to keep in take account, they weren't talking about somebody intentionally hitting the building,
right,
too. They were saying, you're talking about fog, that somebody would eventually see the building and try to steer away from it. And then it might graze it, it might hit it. But they weren't talking about somebody intentionally aiming for the building in clear skies and trying to actually maximize impact. I mean, there's one of the impacts. You actually see the plane rotate to the side so that it can hit as much of the building as possible.
Right, right.
So that's an even greater impact than they accounted for. I don't think they thought anyone was going to intentionally try to take the
right, because what pilot would be flying at 1,000 feet at 490 miles an hour? No one would be doing it. It's just one of those things you just can't account for they didn't account for when they designed the building. The other thing that Leslie Robertson mentions is that the fuel load. In the 1960s, liquid modeling isn't what we know it as today. I mean, you know, we have computers that can crunch the numbers, and we have a pretty good idea of when explosive fuels hit a building, how they'll impact a building and what will happen, where we'll go. 1960s, they didn't have anything like that kind of technology that we enjoy today. So, you know, in hindsight, we could say, oh, how can we even plan for something like that? But you really have to think of their time, and they just didn't have that technology that we enjoy. So slide number 9B, basically I want to give people a sense of the scope of how large the plane was in terms of the size of the building. And so in this slide, we're looking at a top-down view, and the 767, which is the last slide, the bottom slide in that deck, that gives you a sense as to how large this plane was in relation to the building that it hit.
And the blue square, that represents the actual center columns?
Blue square in the middle.
Of the jet, where it shows that.
The blue square is that's a floor plan of a typical high rise.
High rise.
Yeah, this was a graphic done by FEMA, so I actually wouldn't have put that in there. It doesn't make any sense. But the larger square that plane is in, that's the floor plan of the World Trade Center towers.
But I have to make it assume based on the picture you showed earlier that if it doesn't hit all of the support columns, it certainly hits a majority of them crashing through that.
Right. Right.
Even if it hit a side and didn't hit direct center, you're still going to hit a majority of those support columns. I mean, that seems like the perfect attack if you wanted to take this thing down.
Yeah, exactly right. And so this building type was uniquely vulnerable to this kind of attack. And that's something no one could have accounted for. No one knew that. So we talked a little bit about speed. They thought that the plane would hit the building at about 180 miles an hour. Well, the way it works is that an object's speed, the amount of energy it gives off, is inversely proportional by its square to how fast it's going. So if it's twice as fast, it's four times as much energy. If it's three times as fast, it's nine times as much energy. So here we are. Here we're talking about almost three times as much energy, probably four times as much energy hitting the building that they could have accounted for. So the fact that the building's actually held up is a real testament to the fact that engineering wasn't so bad. So let's go to the next point. We've kind of beat that one down. Let's go to the next point that 9/11 truthers have made, and we're going to go to slide deck 10A, and that is the hallmarks of controlled demolition. All right. So why controlled demolition? Why do you think? I want to ask a truther, why do you think there was controlled demolition? I mean, that's so obvious. Why not just tip the building over?
Yeah, I mean, the one question I have is tipping the building over would actually be far more of, I mean, if the goal, and it seems to be the consensus that truthers have, is that this was a staged attack to create fear to accomplish a political goal. And it seems like the building tipping over would be far more effective at that. And it seems like even before, I mean, I watched some of the news footage of this again yesterday, and it had actually been a couple years. It really seems like the smoking hole was terrifying enough. People were terrified. I remember when I had actually slept through what was the initial attack. I mean, we're on the West Coast.
Yeah.
But when I first turned on the TV, it was just a smoking hole, and that was terrifying. It seems like you wouldn't actually need to bring the building down. And there's another question. What had happened if one of the planes had missed? What if only one of the buildings had been brought down? Certainly there'd be an investigation of all the nearby buildings, to make sure that it's safe, that people can go back inside of it. They would have found those charges. And it seems like at that point, your entire story falls apart. And why these conspiracy theorists tend to create this sort of straw man villain who's both simultaneously brilliant and a moron at the same time.
Right, right.
Where any one thing could have made this whole plan fall apart.
Right. It's kind of this family circus style of terrorism. Instead of just a straight line, you're going over the fence and behind the yard and you're circling through the pool and you're going through a neighbor's backyard and you're getting some candy and it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Let's talk about why do you have controlled demolitions? You have controlled demolitions so you don't affect the buildings around the building you want to destroy. That's why you have controlled demolitions. And truthers assert that that's why they did it as well, is that instead of just destroying it in some really dramatic fashion of tipping the building over, that they didn't want to destroy buildings around it. So
it seems like that's counterintuitive to what they want.
Right, right. That for some reason, maybe the Port Authority decided, no, we don't want to destroy all the buildings in the area.
It seems like there were, I've heard estimates of something like 50,000 workers in that building before it was evacuated. It seems like bringing it down even further would create even more fear. So it doesn't make sense that they'd want to make this building collapse safe.
Right, right. One thing about the controlled demolitions that you mentioned earlier is that if no controlled demolitions were found in the other building, then that would be the masterstroke of the Bilderbergers, because that's how the conspiracy theorists would think of it. Is that, well, they knew that, all right, they once they saw that the other building didn't hit, their emergency squad came in and cleared out all the thermite. It just you can't, when your opponent is the shadowy thing that it's elusive
and
you can't touch with unlimited resources, control anyone and everyone will lie for them.
Absence of evidence is just evidence of a cover-up at
right,
that point.
Right, exactly.
I mean, it really is. It's such a cheap thing.
Right. So let's go back to the hallmarks of controlled demolitions. In a nutshell, most demolitions follow this pattern, that core columns are exposed to allow for the placement of explosives. You can't just put it on a wall. You actually have to touch the steel.
Some people would have been able to see this.
Right. I mean, presumably they could have, you know, I've actually looked at the blueprints. They could have gone through the elevator shaft. But when you consider how much thermite was needed to make this thing happen, it doesn't hold up. So, you know, I won't say that it's entirely impossible, but it's extremely hard and extremely unlikely. So anyway, columns would have to be exposed for the placement of explosives. Explosives, including deck cord, primer cap, wiring, would have to be placed on the key supports.
And none of this was found in the rubble afterwards.
None of it. And you know, they like to say that the rubble was just shifted off. That it was, you know, pretty much curtains went up and people just took it away in, you know, mysterious trucks. But it was sifted through carefully on belts in Fishkill, New Jersey, or New York, wherever it was. They sifted through each chunk of debris so that they can get personal effects out in bones and things like that. So this stuff was gone through by thousands of people.
But somebody would have seen something. I mean, We basically, one of the chief arguments they make is that this thing fell at free fall speed.
Right.
And if that's the case, we're basically talking about every explosive on every floor going off without a hitch, no duds, that there'd have to be no resistance to this thing collapsing.
Right.
So how is it, that seems incredibly unlikely. It seems like one of these things would not have gone off, especially when we're talking about how many floors on this tower?
There are 110 floors. Yeah.
And how many support columns?
47 support columns. I forget how many perimeter columns.
So it seems like on every single one of those, despite the fact that you have people working in these towers, you have a janitorial staff working in these towers, and you'd actually have to cut into the wall to get at these supports, and you'd have to do this on every floor. I can understand them saying, oh, there's construction on floor 82 again.
Right.
But you can't have construction on every single floor, and even then, let's just say you did and you had these things there, they could have gone off way before the attack.
Right.
If you're spending a year to gear this
and
thing
up. And how do you get explosives to not go off in an office fire?
Yeah.
How do you, you know, you have a building exploding, you know, by a jet hitting it. How do you not have the demolitions go off then?
Yeah.
How does that not happen? So it just, it doesn't hold up. Anyway, we got a lot of ground to cover. Let's keep moving.
Let's keep moving.
So anyway, the biggest thing that, the biggest takeaway from here that I really want to cover is that controlled demolitions have flashes and percussive booms. And that's something that is absent, completely absent from all footage of World Trade Center towers. Now the truthers like to say that, well, there were explosions found in the basement, about a few minutes before the building's collapse. But in no case of controlled demolitions do explosives go off in the basement, count to 10 minutes, and then the rest of the building comes down. And that's never happened.
It's not like Wile E. Coyote where you hang in the air for a second before falling.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
Right. It doesn't make any sense. That's not how controlled demolitions are done. And here's where that elusive thing goes in, where we look at these hallmarks of controlled demolitions, and each one that we cross off that doesn't follow this pattern, people attribute to the brilliancy of either the Bush administration or whoever that, oh yeah, they knew that people would think it was controlled demolition, so therefore they put in demolitions that didn't have a flash or didn't have a primer cord or didn't have these things, but they had it collapse on its own footprint.
Ugh.
Which part of it, it doesn't make any sense. Either they wanted a controlled demolition or they didn't.
Yeah,
that's the part that's not
it seems
up.
Like even if they had like a bomb, I mean, that's what basically happened in 1993. There was a bomb in like the parking garage. Even if it went off, but it didn't collapse the building, or it left a big gaping hole in the building, or it made it incredibly dangerous to the point you'd have to take it down, isn't that scary enough?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I've heard the using this as the truthers talk about this being a diversion to create a pretense for war. When have we ever needed to do this to go to war before?
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry. Has it really been that hard to create a propaganda campaign to go into a war?
Right. It just doesn't make any sense. So anyway, we have a lot of ground to cover. Let's keep moving. So I want to play clip 10B, which is the National Geographic did this. They did a test of leading truther claims. One of the things they did was they tested the effects of jet fuel versus steel. So why don't we go ahead and play that? I think it's fascinating, not only in the science that they present, but in the reactions of truthers after they see the video. So why don't we go ahead and play that?
First of all, no steel frame high-rise building has ever come down in a total collapse because of any external damage or fire, even fire lasting 12, 15 or more hours.
Jet fuel is basically kerosene, which is a hydrocarbon. It doesn't burn any hotter than desks or chairs in the building. So it's not some massive fuel that can melt steel.
In this test, a steel I-beam like those in the Twin Towers will be subjected to the heat from a jet fuel fire. The same flammable liquid spilled from the crashed airliners. Will the fire burn hot enough to deform the steel within the same window of time as the original structural failure? Will the metal maintain its structural integrity? Within 2 minutes, the thermocoupler temperature peaked just above 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Complete structural failure took less than 4 minutes. The steel twisted in the heat and the weights fell off. But evidence, no matter how conclusive, is still subject to debate. To fully understand the dynamics of an alleged 9/11 conspiracy, one must also observe how truthers process information that challenges their beliefs.
Managed to stand for more than 5 minutes.
We shared the results of this test with two truthers conversant with these fire issues.
It is going to lose strength and it will fail.
Okay, yeah, let's stop here. I think I know where this guy's going. He's going to test an isolated piece of steel. If so, that's a straw man argument.
This test does not refute or even address the overwhelming evidence for explosive controlled demolition.
Gage believes the entire experiment is irrelevant, and it ignores his own conclusion that the collapse was due to controlled demolition.
This is the reason I say that it's irrelevant, because they have experiments like this that show that steel weakens in fires. It's easier and more profound for me to say it's irrelevant. You can turn the steel into a noodle. We still have the evidence for explosive controlled demolition, which they do not refute.
David Griffin also believes the experiment is irrelevant, but for different reasons.
This shows that under ideal artificial conditions, you can get jet fuel to burn at 2,000 degrees. So to have something analogous to this little experiment with this little tiny piece of uninterconnected steel, you're going to have a very long fire lasting 18 to 2,000 degrees to get anything like that. So I would say this experiment shows absolutely nothing of relevance to the issue.
Okay, so that clip shows two things. One, the viscoplastic deformation of steel in under 4 minutes, and a theologian telling a scientist you did it wrong. And that's the part I love, is that David Ray Griffin can say, you know what, you did that test completely wrong.
Yeah.
And
I'm just so tired of people who basically spend 2 hours on the internet telling a trained scientist that they're wrong about
right,
something.
Right, right. Yeah. So one thing I love about that clip is the cognitive dissonance that occurs on the part of truthers when confronted with evidence that runs contrary to their view about 9/11. Is that this whatever it is you've done, you did it wrong. With no effort to tell them what they could have done right or how can we work together to make this thing happen. In fact, that's one of the things I find about when I look at the 9/11 truther sites is that there's no modeling. There's no actual real science done. It's all attacks done against NIST. There's no real science of their own. And in parts where we actually saw some evidence in their favor, you could see that it's been distorted. And hopefully we'll have time at the end of the show to look at that.
I can't help but see the creationist parallel again, that instead of actually providing any positive evidence, they just simply attack the scientific consensus and think that somehow affirms their beliefs.
Exactly right, exactly right. So I'm looking at the clock, and we got to move along. We have a lot of stuff to cover. So I really want us to go ahead and play clip 11A. This is a clip regarding the topple over scenario, and it really gives you a sense as to how difficult it would be for the top of the tower to tip over based upon the design of the building. So if that's queued up, please go ahead and fire that up now. Okay. So in a nutshell, it's a steel tube inside of a tube design, and what's required is angular momentum for the entire top to tip over. A lot of people like to think of a building as a tree trunk. And the top, and it's a solid thing that can tip over just like a tree would if you chopped it. But the World Trade Center towers were largely hollow. Why don't we go ahead and load that clip and play it, and you'll see exactly what I mean. If more people understood what angular momentum was, how that physical principle worked, I think fewer people would become truthers. Once they got that simple principle of there wasn't an anchor point for the whole top of the building to tip over, once they got that, I think that the whole controlled demolition thing falls apart. Another thing with regards to falling in on its own footprint, I was hoping we could pull up slide 11B. And this is a top-down view of the World Trade Center plaza. Each of the World Trade Center towers in itself is 1 acre. And if we can look at the debris pattern, now the World Trade Center plaza itself is 16 acres wide. You can see how far all this debris fell. If I were hiring someone to do a controlled demolition and I got these results, I'd fire him. This is terrible. You've destroyed all the buildings in the perimeter. You've actually done the exact opposite that I wanted you to do. If the building had fallen over, it probably would have done less damage to surrounding buildings because it would have affected fewer buildings. You know, let's take a look at slide 11C. This is a view of the debris. This is actually an actual picture of the site. I mean, is that what a controlled demolition looks like? Show me a video where it destroys all surrounding buildings quite like that. It's obviously not quite right. Slide 11D shows a section of the World Trade Center towers falling on top of the Marriott. Now, a lot of truthers, they'll say, do you know what happened to World Trade Center 7? Because most people don't know some of the particulars. And they'll cite that as evidence for the fact that this was an inside job because you're ignorant about a certain building. So I like to say to them, well, what happened to World Trade Center 3? They don't know, and I like to cite that as evidence for their own ignorance. They don't know the details.
Is it their claim that World Trade Center 7 was also detonated using controlled demolition?
Yes, and we're going to cover that in another show because just so much information to cover. But for today, we're going to do Trade Center Towers 1 and 2. So finally, looking at slide 11E, this is the result of that debris hitting World Trade Center Tower 3. And When we get to it, you'll see that the building is pretty much sheared in half.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. It's going to take a minute. We're all right. Apparently, we have to keep talking.
Yeah, this is the fun of live TV.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
But yeah, that is devastating.
Yeah. Hopefully, they will have it. Go ahead and pull that up for us.
Oh,
there we
geez.
Go. Yeah, the building is pretty much sheared in half. Is that evidence of falling in on its own footprint? Is that what a controlled demolition looks like? Because to me, that's actually a pretty bad job. So because we have a lot of ground to cover, I'm going to ask the booth to go ahead and play clip number 12 for us. This debunks the whole notion of the buildings falling down at free fall speed. Richard Gage loves to have this demonstration where he holds two cardboard boxes. One cardboard set of cardboard boxes has a simulation of the World Trade Center Tower underneath it. The other one is completely, it's got nothing underneath it. He drops both. Obviously, the one with nothing underneath it falls immediately, and the other one hits the top of the tower and kind of stands there. And for him, that's evidence of controlled demolition, because this section fell at free fall speed, therefore controlled demolitions had to blow out all the debris and all the things underneath it, whereas the other one got stuck. So why don't we go ahead and roll the clip about free fall speed, and we're going to debunk how long it took for the columns to fall, for the towers to fall.
Do you know how fast it took those towers to fall?
I don't have the exact
9 seconds. You know how fast it would have taken something to free fall with no resistance from the top of that building? 9 seconds. It's physically impossible.
It reveals that much of the central core remained momentarily intact when the outer walls fell.
Seconds. It's physically impossible.
So we don't have a lot of time, and we still have a lot of ground to cover, so I'm just going to ask the booth to go ahead and queue up the next clip, which is with regards to thermite versus steel. National Geographic also ran the leading idea of the truthers is that thermite brought the buildings down, that
regular file just fire just couldn't melt steel.
Right, right. The thermite had to be placed. And the reason why they stuck on thermite is that there are clips of showers of sparks coming out from the side of one of the towers, that rivers of molten steel were placed. And that's why they're stuck on this whole idea of thermite. So why don't we just see how much thermite it takes to burn through a section of steel that is 1/8 the thickness of the core columns of the World Trade Center Tower. So why don't we go ahead and roll that clip, National Geographic.
The thermite is not going to explode. It's not going to cause a boom. What you're going to see is basically a fire. It's going to be a much slower process.
The team scaled their experiment to see if the steel column, somewhat smaller than those in the World Trade Center, could be sheared with 175 pounds of commercial-grade thermite. If thermite melts through this steel column, the theory of a thermite-controlled demolition may have some validity. While the truthers insist that more explosive super thermite could have been used in the tower demolitions, testing conventional thermite can illuminate this physical process and answer a simple question. Can thermite of any type burn through steel beams?
Lining it with clay wasn't a total success. We can see where the clay broke off. But it looks like most of the material just basically boiled out, and we did not get that heating action that we wanted on the column.
Despite 175 pounds of thermite packed around the steel column, it remained undamaged. Our results seem clear. If thermite can't melt this small column, it wouldn't have had a chance to melt through the much larger columns in the Twin Towers. Not surprisingly, the truthers questioned these results.
And we did not get that heating action that we wanted on the column.
This guy is going back and forth between super thermite and thermite. He's talking just ordinary macro thermite. I mean, he pointed out he couldn't get the other stuff. Stephen can't get it either. So all you can do is read the literature. The military has all of this. They don't share it.
Super thermite in the sol gel form can be painted on. It's not until it dries and hardens that it becomes explosive.
While Stephen Jones envisions an easy thermite application, Emmertech asserts that even if this military substance could be found, it still would not have been practical to use.
If you take just a thin layer of thermite, it'd be tough to light to begin with, but even if you did, it's just going to flash, and there's hardly any energy there.
So is the argument then, oh, well, even though you find super thermite-looking residue, it doesn't make sense, so we just won't do an investigation. We'll just kind of ignore the residues that you found that blow up today because we can't figure out how they could do it, and therefore we don't have to look.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess what I find so disingenuous about this is that you can see these guys just simply trying to poke holes in somebody else's experiment, but they don't have the intellectual honesty or curiosity to say, well, let's do that experiment again and let's fix it. Let's do it right.
Right.
They just want to sort of naysay it and poke fun and walk away.
Right. Yeah, in that clip, there was 175 pounds of thermite attached to an I-beam that was 1/8 the scale of what was in the World Trade Center towers. So even if that worked, that would mean they'd need about, what, 8 times as much. So 32, whatever it was.
More than 8 times because it scarred it, but it didn't.
Right. I'm just saying if that experiment had worked. So anyway, one of the chief criticisms in that clip is that they couldn't find nanothermite. So who can find nanothermite for us? Well, there's just one person. Roll that clip for us if it's ready.
There's something about 9/11 our government doesn't want us to know.
Jesse Ventura is investigating the 9/11 conspiracy and a claim that the World Trade Towers were brought down by an explosive substance called super thermite.
People, did we find anybody who can back up Professor Jones's findings?
Yes, we did. We contacted the research lab at New Mexico Tech, and they've agreed to conduct an experiment using super thermite.
Right. This is Van Romero. He's one of their top researchers, and he's going to do the test.
Hello, Governor. My name is Van Romero, and I understand you have some questions about superthermite. Well, let's do an experiment. The first step in the experiment is to make the liquid superthermite. We mix it in with the paint, and then we have our superthermite liquid paint. Once we make the mixture in the lab, we take it out into the field to do the test. Before we apply superthermite to a beam, let's take a beam without superthermite on it and subject it to a fire. 3, 2, 1, fire. As you can see, fire burns and the beam slowly heats up.
The beam burns briefly, but it does not melt.
Now let's paint the superthermite onto the metal beam, subject it to a fire, see what happens. Fire! As we expected, the beam with the thermite is burning much brighter. It's a much hotter fire than we had before. So the temperature is going to rise in this beam more than it would in the beam without the thermite. Does it burn long enough and hot enough so that we have structural failure?
All right. Anybody still got any doubts?
All right, did you catch that? The announcer says, did the fire burn hot enough and long enough to deform the steel? And they broke away before the experiment concluded. Jesse Ventura says, does anybody have any questions? It's just slimy. So for the heck of it, go ahead and put up slide 14B. I emailed Van Romero and I asked him, do you feel the conclusions that you made in this experiment were reflected accurately in the show?
Okay.
And Van Romero said, absolutely not. The test that we showed conclusively that the thermite had no structural effect on the beam. The video we provided to the show is edited to imply a much different result than what was observed.
Okay. Yeah, it's just straight dishonesty. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have. We are going to be, as always, meeting at the RAM.
Yes.
This time at U Village at 5 o'clock. And it's
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock, yes. Now. And we're going to be joined by
Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.